Jeremy Brecker, welcome to KABU.
Hi, good to be with you again, Bill.
Jeremy Brecker is an activist, a writer, a co-founder of the Labor Network for Sustainability. He wrote the book Strike. The third updated edition is now available. The book Strike was a revelation for me as to how great uprisings from below, like the civil rights and other movements, inspired then the 60s, which changed history. His work on the climate crisis include Against Doom, a climate insurgency manual, and Climate Insurgency, a strategy for survival. They envision mass global nonviolent action to force the mobilization of all resources, as the U.S. did in World War II, to reconstruct the economy and ways of life, that to restore the ecosystems upon which our lives depend. Recently, his essay, The Green New Deal, Dash from Below, calls attention to the great range of climate action organizations and efforts in this country. So Jeremy Brecker, in this interview, will be discussing several of the areas, many of them in which people have organized. First, though, give us a sense of why you wrote The Green New Deal from Below, and give us a sense of the great range of necessary steps and range of movements pressuring to take those steps.
Well, I think many of us felt, as the idea of the Green New Deal emerged, that it was really the first widely popular and force with some political support that took the need for radical action to address climate crisis seriously. And it was a very hopeful development. And then I think many of us were surprised when Joe Biden ran and was elected that, although he did not endorse the Green New Deal per se, he proposed programs that were quite serious about addressing climate issues. And we saw legislation emerging from the Biden administration and from Congress that looked like not enough, but a serious attempt to deal with the climate crisis and to do what the Green New Deal idea, which was to use the necessity for addressing the climate crisis and for tremendous economic activity to change our economy to be climate safe, that at the same time we could incorporate a vast jobs program and major changes that would lead to greater economic, social, and racial justice in our country. And I think many of us were surprised, had our fingers crossed, that at least something along that line might emerge. And since then, I think many of us have gotten more and more discouraged at what has actually happened as the fossil fuel industry has exercised its power over the Congress and to some extent over the Biden administration to back away from serious climate protection. The Build Back Better legislation has been cut more than in half. Most important climate parts that would actually begin reducing fossil fuel emissions have been largely withdrawn from the bill, and the question of whether the Build Back Better program will actually pass is more and more being put in question by Democratic senators like Joe Manchin, who are overwhelmingly creatures of the fossil fuel industry themselves. So part of the origin of this story was the Green New Deal looked like a very, very promising development, but now seeing the beginnings of attempts to legislate it and to put it into administration policy seem to be meeting tremendous opposition from the fossil fuel industry and its allies. So meanwhile, I started just noticing that there were programs and projects developing all over the country that incorporated some of the principles and ideas and goals and programs of the Green New Deal. They weren't being talked about that way because the Green New Deal initially was focused on federal legislation. But in fact, many of the themes of that legislation were being incorporated at a city level, at a state level, by local communities, by trade unions, by institutions like hospitals and universities. They were doing their own sort of little Green New Deals, and I began to think of it as this is the Green New Deal from below. And I was partially led to think in that direction because I've done some studying and research on the original New Deal and have been very impressed that it wasn't just something that Franklin D. Roosevelt was doing from the president's office leading the country to pursue. There really was a national Green New Deal movement that existed all over the country in which hundreds of thousands of people participated in local campaigns, in projects to rebuild local roads and to put on theater for the masses in parks, and a whole range of other socially needed projects that were the local dimension of the original New Deal. And as I looked, I said, my goodness, people are doing the same thing now. They're creating at a local and state level a Green New Deal. It responds to some of the themes that have been advocated by the proponents of the Green New Deal nationally, but it isn't waiting for them. It's people locally and at a state level, regionally, and in institutions like unions and others going ahead and starting their own Green New Deal from below. And as soon as I realized that that was what was going on, I realized I have to write about this and tell people what's going on here, because if it becomes widely known, it will inspire even more efforts by other people who will see that it's possible.
And when it becomes widely known that many of the, for example, the technologies of producing clean energy do work and are cheaper and more reliable than what the investor-owned utilities, in my hypothesis, I think you agree with, when we see that all the technologies are available and the social justice part is also possible to achieve, like universal medical care, it seems to me that that's part of the impetus of a great movement, a great Green New Deal movement. They have to have a goal, which is, my sense is, people are more likely to organize when they see a goal that's achievable and would work and would improve their lives.
And that's what's happening to a very surprising extent. You can find, even in places that have politics that are not supportive to Green New Deal type goals, you're seeing this happen on a large scale. For example, in Texas, there is now the leading state for wind power. Huge investments in windmills, and Lord knows they have the wind, but they are now investing heavily to harness it. And cities like Dallas have not only big wind power projects, but also are deliberately using it to create jobs and using it to make inexpensive energy available to lower-income communities, using it to make jobs available to people who have been largely excluded from the better parts of the job market, and using it to make possible the reduction of fossil fuel burning, both in order to protect the climate and for the betterment of the low-income and people of color communities where fossil fuel plants overwhelmingly tend to be concentrated, so that their kids will suffer less asthma and less pollution-related diseases and get the benefits that are at the core of the social justice, racial justice dimension of the Green New Deal.
This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm talking to Jeremy Brecker, who's wrote quite a good deal of work on the climate crisis and the way out. His books including Against Doom, A Climate Insurgency Manual, and Climate Insurgency, A Strategy for Survival. We've been talking today about a recent article he wrote, The Green New Deal Dash from Below, and we've discussed that so far in this interview. My sense is that we can see what's going on in the United States now as, and we talked about that too, but as the embryo of that mass nonviolent action that you've called for and that you see as necessary. And in the book Strike, you discussed how great movements sometimes arise fairly quickly, unexpectedly, from the inchoate resentment and hopes of people who suddenly realize their subjectivity and come together. You've written a lot about that. We don't really have much time. I mean, the planet doesn't have much time to reduce greenhouse gas in concentration so that we avoid an irreversible global roasting where the heat itself produces more greenhouse gas emissions. from buried crystallized methane and many other sources, warming of the oceans. Jeremy Brecker, in all of the research you've done, tell us about the time spans of these movements. And my sense is the really unexpected, the coming together in a fairly short-term period of movements that no one ever would have anticipated.
Well, you know, when we face big problems, and a lot of us face those problems together, the initial reaction is often, this is too big, I can't deal with this, or, well, I may feel that this is impossible, that we can't go on living with this and we have to change things, but I look around me and I see that most other people aren't paying any attention to it. And it's not only easy, but it's very, very common for people to despair of being able to do anything about the problems they face. And the problems initially make them be inactive rather than becoming activists. And you can see this happening over and over again. And it's only when there's an accumulation of the unbearableness of the problems and at the same time a recognition that other people are facing those problems and other people are beginning to understand, to see, and to feel the need to act on those problems, that you begin getting large-scale collective action. And once that realization sets in, then people can begin to act and to move on their perception of the problems and the necessity of dealing with them with surprising speed. And you see this many times when you look at the history of popular movements. You can see it, for example, in the development of labor movement in the United States in the 1930s, in the period of the Great Depression, where there was basically a demobilization and a demoralization of the American working class, and conditions of the Depression became more and more affecting the minds of American workers and even their physical existence. And there were occasional flare-ups where people began to express in local communities or in particular industries their discontent with the conditions they were facing. But it was all of a sudden, really, at the end of 1935 and in early 1936, that a vast wave of sit-downs began to occur. And seemingly out of nothing, although out of a lot of barely visible organizing activity and self-organizing activity, a huge wave of sit-down strikes spread across the nation and forced the major American employers like General Electric and Ford and others in a number of industries to do what they had been refusing and even using armed force to prevent, which was the unionization of their workers. So that would be one example right there. More recently, we've seen the development of the civil rights movement in the late 1950s and early 1960s, which again, the predominant form of activity for civil rights had been to bring lawsuits and to lobby for government policies, and eventually immense frustration with that and a feeling of its fruitlessness led large parts of the black population of the United States and also very large numbers of white people who became progressively disgusted with the brutal racist treatment of black people, led to the rise of major confrontations like the Montgomery bus boycott, like the drills in Birmingham and other southern cities that used mass action and other forms of nonviolence to challenge segregation and to eventually defeat many aspects of segregation in the streets, city by city, and throughout the South, and also to create a national crisis where the national government and the national political system were forced to pass the civil rights law and the voting rights law that changed the entire legal structure that had allowed and coddled segregation and racism as part of the official policy of the southern states and the unofficial policy of the United States government. So that would be another example. Let's quickly come up to some very recent ones, and I'll talk about two. One was Occupy Wall Street, which started with a couple hundred people occupying a park in New York City and became a nationwide phenomenon with occupations ongoing in hundreds of American cities and eventually a worldwide movement with simultaneous actions going on in thousands of cities. Some people believe that it had no effect and that it was just a lot of froth and had no impact. And it is true that in a relatively short time, a couple of months, the occupations were pretty much defeated by police force action and occupiers driven out of their occupations. But when you look a little further, you discover that, for example, the Fight for 15 movement, which is probably the most effective movement of poor workers, certainly since the 1930s, was a direct outgrowth of Occupy Wall Street, both in the tactics it used and many, many of the organizers and activists in Fight for 15 were people who had gotten their first exposure to challenging the system from their participation in Occupy Wall Street. And the only other thing that I'll say about the impact of Occupy Wall Street is that in the aftermath of Occupy Wall Street, Barack Obama began saying that the great issue of the United States in this era is inequality. And that's something that's unimaginable to have a president of the United States say prior to Occupy Wall Street. It completely changed the discourse in the country around questions of inequality. And then just to wrap up, and I'm skipping over a whole bunch of quite dramatic cases, including the Women's March, which was certainly one of the largest, if not the largest, protest movements in the United States up to that time. But dwarfing all of them was the Black Lives Matter movement that developed in response to the brutal, and it goes beyond that. It was like a demonstration act of racial brutality in the killing of George Floyd. And in the United States, the best estimates are that there were at least 15 million people who went out on the streets and participated in actions for Black Lives Matter, despite the COVID pandemic and the risks that they were taking by doing so. And that also has had a transformative effect on the commitment of significant parts of the political system to begin addressing America's almost unfathomable racial oppression.
This is Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole on Cable Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon, talking to Jeremy Brecker, co-founder of the Labor Network for Sustainability. Among other books, he wrote Climate Insurgency, A Strategy for Survival. Recently, he published an article, The Green New Deal, From Below. Today was part one of a two-part interview. We discussed the great range of climate action organizations and efforts in this country today, how all those struggles from below, from the grassroots, they represent an embryo that might well develop into mass nonviolent action to force the mobilization of all resources, as did the U.S. in fighting World War II to defeat the Nazis. Today, that great mobilization of our resources is to restore the ecosystems upon which our lives depend, particularly the climate system. Next week, we discuss how this could come about, examining precedents for this mass nonviolent action in the U.S., like the 60s civil rights insurgency, and before that, the labor movement of the 30s and 40s. You can find Jeremy Brecker's book on jeremybrecker.org. That's J-E-R-E-M-Y. BRECHER.ORG. One final note. COVID has stressed KBOO fundraising, and without funds, we cannot produce radio. And you will not hear from Noam Chomsky, Jeremy Brecker, Bill McKibben, Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman, Naomi Klein, Angela Davis, and so many other of the most thoughtful and inspiring people. on our endangered planet. So please go to the KABU website, become a member, or make a donation.